It's time for Mac Break Weekly. Leo's on vacation, but Andy, Alex, and Renee are all here. We're going to talk about Apple's indestructible new sapphire display. The glass looks amazing. We'll see if it really works on the phone itself. We're going to talk about Tim Cook's Apple. He's been in charge for 3 years, and how has the company changed in those 3 years? And we're going to talk about the iWatch, of course. Apple's made an interesting hire, which sort of changes the whole picture for their coming watch and even for the marketing for the whole company. It's all coming up right now on Mac Break Weekly.
Netcasts you love
from people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 410, recorded July 8, 2014. Please remove your piercings. Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Audible.com. To download a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/MacBreak. And by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create your own professional website or online portfolio. For a free 2-week trial and 10% off, go to squarespace.com and use the offer code MacBreak. It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where we cover the wonderful and extremely profitable world of Apple. And with me is the usual cast of characters. I, of course, am not Leo Laporte. I am Mike Elgin, the news director here at Twit, and I'm sitting in for him while he's on vacation, taking it easy. And we're working hard here at the Twit Studios. With me is, we'll start with Andy Iannacco. Andy Iannacco is with the Chicago Sun-Times, and he's a technology columnist there. And welcome, Andy Iannacco.
It is very nice to be here, being welcomed by you, Mike.
Thank you so much. And I was impressed by your extreme knowledge and distaste for haggis before we started the show. So that was an interesting conversation that you all missed.
Well, I'm proud of it. I'm proud of it because I've never had haggis. So it's based solely on ignorance and arrogance, which is a very American thing to do just so soon after July 4th.
Well, thank you for waving the flag, and I guess that's the right way to do. Eventually, we'll have a food show here. Mark my words, we will someday have a food show here on the Twit Network, and we should have a haggis day where we all wear kilts and talk about food we've never tried. So that's something to look forward to. Renee Ritchie is with us as well. Of course, he runs iMore and is a serial podcaster and podcasts and hosts a lot of podcasts that end with the word cast. Welcome, Renee Ritchie.
As someone whose family hails from Edinburgh, you know, the fighting sept of the Clan MacIntosh, I am appalled by all this anti-Scottishism on this show.
Have you tried haggis?
No, I have not.
Okay, well, there you go.
I have.
Well, it's so you're, you know, this. See, Canadians always try to pretend like they're so different from Americans, but you haven't tried haggis either, so.
It's too cold here to make haggis, Mike.
Yeah, it's a good point, good point. And it's got oatmeal in it. I mean, come on.
Yeah.
And also with us is Alex Lindsay of Pixel Corps fame, and welcome back to the United States of America.
Thank you.
And you were in Rwanda celebrating a very, very major event there.
Yeah, it was the 20th anniversary of the end of the genocide. So, and basically their Independence Day, which is July 4th as well.
Yeah.
So there's a big event at the stadium, and it's quite a thing. You know, events in stadiums in Africa are much different than here.
Yeah.
You know, people started, it was amazing. We walked out while we were working on camera angles with our camera operators, and the event doesn't start until 11 o'clock in the morning. The people start coming at 6.
Yeah.
So they're all, the whole stadium is full by 8, and then they all just start singing. Like, it was just like, you know, and they're not all singing, like, one section will start singing something, and then someone else will say, I don't understand, you know, some of it was religious, and some of it was patriotic, and some of it was probably just fun, but it was just like these random, you know, it was quite a...
And spontaneous.
Quite an experience. It literally, a whole section. Just, and they're going, I mean, they're moving, they're jumping up and down and singing and everything else, and it's just, I was just like, oh, they're way cooler than we are.
Well, you know? And also, we've got the question engine going for the show today, so you're managing that. So if you want to ask a question, how do they do that?
Go to, I believe it is it twit.to/MBW410, is that right? twit.to/MBW410, and you can ask questions or make comments. You can vote stuff up and down, or you can let us know, you know, what you want us to talk about. So it's,
Yep, that link works
great.
Well.
So there it is. So, and you can, of course, as he said, watch the show live there as well. So I've got something for us all to sing about spontaneously. I don't know if you've seen the video created by Marques Brownlee. Marques Brownlee, of course, is a very well-known YouTube personality who who he tests a lot of mobile devices. He does some really nice videos reviewing phones especially. And he posted a video yesterday showing what he says is an iPhone 6 screen made with Sapphire. And he was shanking it with a knife pretty hard there and scratching with the keys. And the thing came
out. Is that the technical term, Mike?
Yes, it is. I learned it in prison. But he did a pretty abusive test on this screen. Again, just the screen, not a whole phone behind it, just the so-called Sapphire screen. And it didn't have a mark on it. He was bending it. He was stepping on it. He was stabbing it with a knife, a very sharp knife. And this looked very impressive. He also, in this part of the video, as we're seeing here,
how did
if
he
you're
get
watching
it?
The video, he didn't say.
he got it from Sonny Dixon, who's in Australia, who has
good sources
with the Chinese parts suppliers.
That's right, he did say. He also talked about the clarity, and that was a point of controversy about Sapphire, of course, that people were saying it was going to not let enough light through, and it was inferior to regular glass or Gorilla Glass. But this looks pretty good. What do you think about this, Rene Ritchie? Is this going to be transformative for the iPhone, assuming that this is legit?
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit like reviewing that brand new Lego block that's going to ship later this month with that brand new Lego set, in that it's completely out of context, and it can be a magnificent new Lego block. But, you know, like you pointed out, there's a lot of questions. It's not attached to a phone yet. I think on the face of it, it looks great. Sonny Dixon has a great reputation for getting legitimate Apple parts from the Chinese supply chain. So, I mean, it's likely that it's an authentic part. Whether it's a final part or not, it's hard to say. But Sapphire Glass, I mean, a lot of experts have said for a long time that is where we need to go to have the sort of large size, thin size, strength and flexibility that we need. And based on Marquez's test, it looks like we're getting that.
And of course, Sapphire Glass has been in use by Apple in front of the camera and also
and
in front
ID.
Of the fingerprint reader, where it's very important to have a very accurate and very durable, no scratches and so on. So they've been using this for a while. There have been reports for, it seems like, more than a year about Apple hoarding Sapphire and
right.
building plants and hiring
invested
people.
Invested heavily.
And they've got patents and so on. One of the interesting patents, they've also made an acquisition or two around Sapphire production. But one of the interesting patents that they have, which is a patent for a Sapphire laminate, which the idea of you have a very thin layer of Sapphire bonded to a piece of glass, which enables the part to be thinner, lighter and clearer. And we don't know whether this is an example of a Sapphire laminate or not. We really don't know what this technology is exactly. Do we think that Andy Anako, whether this is something that is going to be revolutionary and difficult to copy by other companies, Android handset makers, for example?
Hard to say, because as tough as that thing is, the question is, how tough does that have to be? We're watching him bend it over the tip of his shoe right now, and essentially there are things inside the iPhone that are not as flexible as that, and they will break long before you do that. I've got my iPhones in my pocket. I've got also a Nexus 5 that I carry usually inside my pocket with no screen protector on it, and that doesn't have really any scratches on it after about a year of daily carry. So it's great that they're choosing this superlative product. Anything that will protect the screen and keep this thing looking pretty is going to be good for users. I'm actually – there are two things that I'm – that are larger takeaway from this video for me. First of all, we're seeing this is usually the time of year when we would expect to start seeing parts kind of slip out of security and make some of these September and October announcements look more real. So now I don't think there's anybody who would doubt that this is going to be the size of one of the new iPhones. The second thing is, as I kept looking closely at that video, I couldn't help but notice that the corners of that screen are not squared off. There's that cover. They're not squared off. They're rounded over, which made me think that is this actually going to be part of the actual profile of the finished product? Are they making something so thin that they're not going to have a band of metal that encapsulates that cover that is going to be fastened over the actual display and that we're going to see sort of this little bubble effect that goes around the sides of it? Who knows? Because as Renee said, we're seeing something completely out of context here, but that really does make the mind wonder a little bit.
For what it's worth, 2 years ago, I heard that the iPhone 6 would have a similar design to the iPod Touch. And then last year, that because of all the new gestures, like back gestures and stuff, that they were experimenting with making the corners smoother so that when you do the bezel gestures, you wouldn't feel a sharp edge under your fingers.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that one of the things that, you know, Apple, obviously this keeps on pushing that the high end up. So this is more expensive to make. There's a lot of patents that slow people down. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of things that if someone is looking for the best phone they can possibly get, this is something that they may have to start adding. It might be a feature that a lot of us are, you know, a lot of us have scratched up our phones, or, you know, often enough that is something that people might buy against. And you can, you know, a lot of the reports out in the last week have been about how Samsung is basically getting squeezed between Chinese manufacturers and Apple, you know, where you have low end stuff coming up and Apple really looks like it's very focused on maintaining the top of the heap. Yep. By continuing to add those technologies and making, you know, everybody else fight for the rest of the market, yeah, which might be a larger, but is lower margin.
I just hope that this is a feature that will actually present itself to the users, because phones are different. You can spend all this time and all this money engineering a beautiful design with all these cutting edge materials, but most people are still just going to slip it into a cheap $14 Hello Kitty rubber case, and so you're not so none of that stuff work that you put in is going to actually present itself to the user. So that's why, again, cool demo video. This is something that you would expect to see from Apple, but again, I wonder if a year from now we're going to see that this people actually care about this cover. Apple, one of the few things that Apple does during their keynote presentations that I think is kind of a misstep is that they will spend a lot more time than is necessary talking about this new welding technique or talking about this material they put into it. And of course, this is something that is first and foremost on their minds as designers, but nobody really cares what this thing is made of, so long as it feels good in the hand and so long as it has a good chance of surviving a drop onto a tile floor.
But they have to feed the hardcore enthusiasts, and those are the people who are going to drive the excitement and stay faithful to the brand if they're given enough detail about all the sweat that went into this technology. And, of course, a lot of Apple's technology is manufacturing processes, and and you know, this stuff is just invisible to the users, as you say. But you end up with weird things that are just kind of vaguely thrilling, if that's a possible.
But isn't it like a two?
I'm not sure that I agree with you about the importance of satisfying hardcore enthusiasts, because we forget that we've been with Apple so long that we always think ourselves at the lost tribe wandering through the desert. when you talk about the iPhone, though. Apple is making the Toyota Corolla. They are making the most popular phone, at least in the United States of America. So they really are selling to generic. I want a phone. I expect to spend $200 for it. I will walk into the store without much of a preconception. I will buy whichever one strikes my fancy. So I'm not sure that this is the sort of thing that will appeal to the target iPhone user. Apple fans will love it and eat it up. People like us who appreciate things like that will eat it up. But I'm not sure the person who just, hey, I dropped my phone in the toilet, what can I get?
No. But I think sometimes, with artwork in general, we can call this technological artwork, you know, the story is about half the value behind it. Right. So the story of what it takes to do is, you know, I just saw, I don't know if you've seen, there's a documentary called Tim's Vermeer.
Yep.
Tim Jensen, who actually invented or started the company that makes TriCasters.
Video toaster.
Figured out a possible way that Vermeer was made. So I didn't even know who Vermeer was. I mean, I'm not very cultured. You know, I'm from Western Pennsylvania. You know, I know a lot about, I can tell you a lot about rifles
famous
and pistols and not so much about Vermeer. But after watching this documentary on my last flight, I was like, I want to know everything about Vermeer. In fact, I want to try to do that. I was like, I don't want to get my little things out and everything else. And the value, and then also the fact that it took him a year and a half to make one, creates an enormous amount of value of that painting, where otherwise it's just a painting that I don't really understand.
So for those listening, what we're talking about is the theory that Vermeer, who was a famous, he was Dutch, right? A Dutch painter?
Yes.
He used a contraption, potentially of his own invention, that used essentially to focus of the light. And his paintings were essentially traces. Some have even called them photographs, because essentially it's projected. The light is projected onto a flat surface where that could be captured in one method or another. And this totally changes the way you look at Vermeer paintings.
Right, and it doesn't. I think that some people thought it would lower the value, but what it actually does is increase the value, because you realize it's an incredible amount of work to do that level of detail. But the point that I'm making is not so much about Vermeer, but is mostly about the fact that when we understand how hard it is to make these pieces, I think that it does change, because the rest of the phones are just regular phones. Yeah. You know, like, you don't know what that they just are objects.
So is the iPhone.
Well, it is, but
I mean,
but
I part think, of the, I think that, I mean,
the distortion I field, the distortion field is created by story. Yeah. you know, that's
well, it just bothers me a little bit.
I think Apple's really good at layering stuff. Ahead, I mean, they're very good at telling that deep story, and it will resonate with geeks, but it'll also form sort of a backstory for everybody else. And they'll say things like 64-bit, double the registers. It enables authentication technology like Touch ID. And you don't have to remember that. If you're a geek, you can. But when you go into the store, all you'll hear is 64-bit. And that sounds like more bits. That's better. And the same thing with this screen. You might hear about the manufacturing process, but at the end of the day, you'll walk into the store and go, Sapphire, does this guy have Sapphire? No, Sapphire sounds better and expensive. And it just creates sort of a multi-layered, I don't know if it's Shakespearean is the right term, but it creates a dialogue on multiple levels. And I think that overall benefits them.
Andy and Ako, you started to say something. Did you have
only that, at this point? Only that, and this is just a personal feeling, yeah, that I don't think it matters how Vermeer painted that painting. It's a beautiful painting. If you think that if someone wants to look at that and say, oh, well, this didn't come strictly from his imagination, he used a mechanical help, then you don't understand art. Similarly, if you were not interested in the music lesson until you found out all the technology behind it, you also are not bringing anything to the art. So that's why it's beautiful to hear the story about how Apple designs these things. And also, oftentimes when you're inside the keynote and you're listening to them talk about how they put this together, I don't denigrate them for that, because it's an extension of the legitimate pride that they take in putting together these things. It's just like if you ask me about a piece of furniture I made, and I will tell you about, oh well, let me show you how I put those dowels in, because it's a very clever technique that allows me to do a very, very tight joint with, because it's a certain amount of pride in what you did to get this together. However, none of that should really matter to the person. This is a phone. It's used to place and receive phone calls. It's used to surf the web. It's used to keep in touch with your family. And it's used to count your calories and your steps per day. And if part of the story of why you should buy this phone instead of the other is that, let me tell you about the technique we used to, let me tell you about how thin we made this. Let me tell you about what we had to do for battery conservation in order to make a battery this thin last just as long as any other phone. Nobody should care about that. All they hear is this battery lasts as long as any other phone, and then they should not care about anything beyond that. So that's just something that personally I'm on guard against, because I am the guy who wants to hear about the new A7, the new A8, the new A9 processor. I really do want to hear about the assembly technique that lets them do something, put together something this tricky. But this, you have to focus on the things that are going to present themselves to an actual user. That's all.
Absolutely. And I tend to disagree on one level, at least, which is that the cumulative effect of all the different things that Apple does, all the crazy manufacturing techniques and the obsession with materials and all that, has an overarching effect of superior quality. If you look at the fingerprint reader right out of the box, the first 1.0 release of their fingerprint reader, it just worked really well compared to every other fingerprint reader I've ever seen. You have, really nice materials. I mean, you don't have this sort of thing. This is my Moto X, which I dropped yesterday, a half an hour before I saw that Marquez video. And I thought, boy, wouldn't that be great? I mean, there's a spectrum of possibilities with Sapphire. One end of the spectrum is the bad news, which is, if Corning is right, the people who make Gorilla Glass, that it will affect the battery life. It'll be a dimmer display. It'll create problems for the screen quality.
Because they have nothing at stake. Yeah,
exactly. That's right. Exactly. And it's a competitor, essentially, to Gorilla Glass, theoretically. That's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is, what if Apple really is onto something here and they have a display that will never scratch except under the most extreme conditions, and that you can carry it around your pocket? This makes a lot of sense for Apple, simply because, we talked about Andy and Ako, you talked about the Hello Kitty case. What if they make a big deal at the announcement of this thing? What if one of the signature attributes of this device, of this phone, is you don't need a case? Apple says flat out, you don't need a case for this. We want you to carry around the naked phone in your pocket with your keys and your change and your sharp knife, unfolded. And you can stab it like Marquez Brownlee, and it won't scratch ever. And, if they make a big enough deal about that, that is a signature issue. I mean, you look at how much effort they put into design, and then nobody ever sees these phones because they have Hello Kitty cases on them, or they're scratched up because they're an iPhone 5 and the metal scratches off, and they don't look that good in that case either.
I think that people put cases on their phones partly because of protection, but mostly because this is the most personal piece of technology that you own. You want it to look like your phone. It's not that you want to protect your phone. It's just that you want people to know that you like Hello Kitty, or that you couldn't get the Pandaba cover when you went to the Sanrio store. So I think that there are a lot of reasons why people like to put cases on their phones. I'm saying that it's a great the Sapphire cover is a great thing if it actually extends the life of the product, and it is adds a layer of durability. Remember that we're seeing a video with stress tests on this flexible Sapphire cover, but it's still going to have to be bonded to a sheet of glass with a digitizer and a display and all that sort of stuff. And that might not be quite as indestructible as the cover that's on it. All I'm saying is that Apple really has to communicate this in terms of real features. Instead of saying, we've figured out why people put cases on their phones, it must be because things get scratched. Guess what? Now you never have to put a cover on the phone again. And then a year later, people are still putting cases and covers on their phones. And Apple is, what the hell is wrong with you people? Didn't we tell you you don't have to put a cover and a case on this phone? Yes, but I love the Denver Broncos. I want people to see the...
Yeah. and my primary reason is just batteries. You know, my Mophie cases just solves that key issue for me that the phone's too small. So anyway, it doesn't have enough battery. But I think that, you know, with all of these things, I mean, Apple has to... I mean, this is their livelihood, is that they have to constantly be coming out with two or three new technologies with every phone that nobody else can produce, at least for the next 6 months.
Yeah.
You know, and that's the market they've chosen. It's not the only market they could have. There's a lot of, you know, HTC and Samsung, but everybody's always coming up with something. I mean, the reason that I carry around an HTC M8 is because of the short depth of field.
Yeah.
And so I can take little pictures for blog posts that look nice, you know, with my phone. And so that was enough for me to pick that as my Android test phone as opposed to something else. And so finding these individual features, I don't think that this is the most important feature. I still think the most important feature that Apple could add to a phone is low light photographic support.
Yes.
So that is, and I think for all of them, I know it's a hard thing to cut, but being able to get, you know, low grain images that are in focus, you know, in a average house at night, would make more difference for anybody buying any phone anywhere. The number one use for a phone is not a phone; it's a camera. Number one, you know, and so this is great. But I really hope that Apple, you know, we see something revolutionary.
Yeah, and of course,
optical image stabilization,
right? And it's these little things that nudge the whole industry forward. And you look at what phones were like 10 years ago; they were horrible compared to today's phones. And today's phones are pretty awesome across the board because everybody's nudging forward. Everybody's doing what you're saying, which is trying to get ahead, and especially Apple trying to get ahead of the competition, who tends to copy them. And so, you know, they have to sort of get ahead if they can.
Well, it's also important in their own product line because you can't do everything every year. You have to, you can do a graphics boost 1 year, you can do a pixel boost 1 year, you can do a camera boost 1 year, just because technology takes a while to get here. So you have to every year find sort of pick your battles and what you can knock out.
Yeah.
I've got a question I'd like to hear everybody talk about. Do you think that we can sort of stop talking about tick and talk releases for phones? I don't think that's been Apple. I think that Apple's dispensing with that, and they're just trying to make the best phone that's practical for any given year.
Go ahead.
I still feel like the S is always like not quite as good as the full release. I think that the S is kind of like we have to do something every year. I always feel like we see a bigger change between every major number than we do on the years in between.
Yeah.
I tend to skip the S's.
Yeah, I think myself. Apple's under a lot of pressure, theoretically, to come out with a big push. I mean, so much of their revenue, so much of their profits come from iPhones. And if they decide, you know what, let's skip a release this year. We'll just do one next year. We won't have a big release in September. We'll just wait until next July or something like that. It would be, there would be months of speculation about the decline of Apple, and, you know, there'd be all kinds of angst around with the shareholders.
Well, and they'd fall behind. I mean, I think the other thing is that you have Samsung releasing, you know, all these phones all the time. I mean, the technology change is changing so fast that doing it every 2 years would be too slow. So I think that adding small features to the S, I mean, you can decide. Here's my thing is I don't think you should buy. I used to buy a phone every year, which is a new iPhone every year. Mm-hmm. And I've kind of decided I'm just going to buy every other phone. So you can decide whether you're on the S track or on the numeral track.
Yeah. See,
but I think buying one every year doesn't make as much sense.
No.
I'd argue that there isn't a TikTok anymore, that Apple is just sort of what I said before, that they can't do everything every year. So 1 year you get the case redesign and a few other things like the screen size. And then the next year, like last year, it was an S model, but it had the A7 chip, which I could not, if we had a twice as long podcast, I could not get over how important that that chipset is and how many things it enabled. And we had, you know, new camera technology, and we had the new ISP in there. There's a Touch ID. There was a lot of stuff internally, and it's not visible. Maybe people on the outside don't see it. Maybe they just see, oh, this year it comes in gold. But I think Apple, sort of as big as they are, they're still resource constrained, and they need to again, pick their battles every year. New case design this year, new chipset, or some other new technology next year.
And I think that one of the things that's important is the fact that Apple, I was talking to a manufacturer that makes a lot of the cases specifically, and they said the fact that it makes it, you get a lot more accessories for the iPhones than you do for a lot of Android phones because it only iterates once a year.
Yeah.
You know, they said it's really frustrating for an accessory manufacturer to have, the Android market is very, very diverse. And it's changing constantly, and they're making all these little changes to the same one, and it creates a lot of consumer confusion. It's very hard for them to tool everything out for all of these different phones. Whereas with an iPhone, it's easy for them, and they make them for both. I mean, they make them for Samsung's, and they said, but by far they sell a lot more because they only have a yearly cycle that they have to make adjustments for.
Yeah, and the I would say
that one of the key features of the iPhone design is the fact that they've gone for this revolutionary thing where it's just it's a monolith. It's square right angles, everything. And that allows you to do accessories like this. They allow you to do accessories like the AlloClip. That would be so difficult to do if you had really complicated rounded edges to it. I really hope that they stick to that because I do think that that a phone is really just a frame that delivers the phone features that you then put into whatever thing you want to carry around in.
Of course, the monkey wrench in Apple's desire to stay on top as the most profitable consumer electronics company in history is China, which presents a couple of issues for Apple. One of them is a huge opportunity. There's so many people who could buy iPhones in China, and of course, a huge amount of their growth is going to happen in China. And the Chinese handset manufacturers are coming on strong and have already taken their toll on Samsung. We got the Samsung release, and Samsung's already talking about to reduce profitability in the future because of these upstart companies in China producing high-quality phones that are very inexpensive. So Samsung's being squeezed on the high end by Apple and on the low end by all these Chinese manufacturers, and to a certain extent in the middle by the same manufacturers. So Apple's really got to own the high end if they don't want to follow Samsung down the hole.
I think a lot of us travel. I mean, I travel a lot around the world. And one of the things is still, no matter what, there's a lot of people that use different phones, but the cultural icon is still the iPhone.
Yeah.
You know, like the people who can get one, mm-hmm. generally have one in a lot of these emerging world countries. And so I think, but part of that is Apple continuing to tell that story and continuing to have that be the thing that they go for the high end. Of course, they could go for the entire market, but I think it's just too hard. I don't think Apple's built for the low end. I don't think they can do that.
Right, and nor should they. Well, let's move on to another story. I mean, there was a really interesting story by Daisuke Wakabayashi and the Wall Street Journal.
Did you practice that like 10 times?
I did practice that. Well, we talked about it on the show earlier today. In fact, we interviewed Daisuke this morning.
I was so impressed.
Yeah, thank you so much. I actually studied Japanese.
Thank you for drawing the curtain, allowing us to see the wizard behind it.
Yes.
Some people like us. Some people like the magic, you know?
I'm sorry, but everybody was thinking it. You know it.
Anyway, so this guy with the hard-to-pronounce name wrote this article in the Wall Street Journal talking about Tim Cook's version of Apple and sort of addressed the question that I think we've talked about on this show before, at least we did when I was a guest on this show a couple of times, which is that how different is Apple without Steve Jobs? How different is Apple under Tim Cook? Tim Cook is a completely different person. And of course, with Steve Jobs and Tim Cook together in the company for several years, that was the dynamic duo of the visionary dictator on one hand and the amazing sort of manufacturing and operations guy on the other hand. And now the visionary dictator has been gone for 3 years. He stepped down as CEO 3 years ago, I think in August. And Tim Cook's been running the show by himself. And the company seems to be changing faster as time goes on. And so, it was a fascinating article, and I wanted to know what you all thought about that. Irene, Richie, what did you think about this article? I mean, is he right? Is this really a much kinder, gentler Apple, friendlier to employees, friendlier to the environment, friendlier to shareholders, and, just a warmer, fuzzier Apple?
Well, I think, and I love his writing. I'll say that up front. I think that the biggest thing about this article to me is that the mainstream is beginning to get a story that people like you and I and Andy and Alex on the show have been talking about for a year and a half, if not 2 years already. You know, going back to when Tim Cook reorganized Apple, it was absolutely clear that this was going to be Tim Cook's apple. It was, you know, that he could not have put a bigger flag in the ground for that. And I think everything that's followed since then shows, you know, sort of the direction that he's going with Apple. I'm happy that the mainstream media is recognizing this now. I'm not sure if 2 years is a good amount of time or if it should have been earlier, or, you know, thankfully it's not later. But the biggest thing I drew from this was just, I thought his comments about the board of directors was apt, because given what Tim Cook has done with the management team and given what he's done with events like WWDC and how he's managing things internally, the board of directors is sort of like the last big institution in Apple that doesn't have his fingerprints on it.
Right, he wants to expand the board, right? He and the people who are currently on the board have been, you know, most of them have been sort of hanging on to the chair that they sit on for many years.
For over a decade, yeah.
Yeah, and it's essentially they're Steve Jobs loyalists. And so, you know, the idea is to sort of expand that.
One of the things that's really interesting about that is that it was a board that Steve Jobs needs. And as much as all these articles keep saying Tim Cook is no Steve Jobs, Steve Jobs did exactly what Tim Cook is doing. Steve Jobs was not good at logistics, and he was not good at supply chain, and he was not good at operations. That's why he got Tim Cook, and Tim Cook has singular skills, and that's why he's getting the people he's getting, because he wants them to compliment him the same way he complimented the skills that were at Apple. So that, to me, is 100% normal.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it definitely, just as it says in the article, it definitely illustrates the whole revolutionary versus, you know, leader. I mean, you know, someone who's going to lead the revolution, someone's going to lead the country is two different people. And I think that Apple could not have gotten to where it is without Steve Jobs pushing that envelope. But to continue to grow and be the company that it is, I think that Cook is perfect for that.
Yeah.
As far as building that out. Because, I mean, I think most of us have heard the stories of Steve.
Yep, absolutely.
So, you know, and so he's a pretty intense guy.
He quotes a former employee as saying that, quote, Steve was a wartime CEO while Tim is a peacetime CEO, unquote. Right. But I'm not sure that Apple is no longer at war. I think that they're facing all kinds of challenges. And, you know, one of the benefits of, you know, one of the reasons Apple came from the brink and rose to become the most profitable consumer electronics company ever is that Steve Jobs was a visionary, and he was a singular kind of personality within the company who could just dictate things. Mm-hmm. Nobody can dictate things anymore. Now, you know, the article talks about Tim Cook as a consensus builder, and everybody likes that. That sounds like a great thing. But, you know, if you talk to anybody who's tried to do something really, really hard, like create a consumer electronics device, right. You know, Hawkins, who created the original Palm Pilot, they will tell you, you need somebody to just crack the whip and say, no, it's going to be like this. We don't care how many engineers think we should have 10 more buttons. There's going to be 4 buttons, period. Mm-hmm. You need somebody to say that kind of thing. And, this is the question. Is Apple the kind of company that can move forward and compete?
I think part of that was an acknowledgement that there isn't going to be another replacement. You know, it's not going to be that way, whether we want it to be or not. I mean, obviously, we didn't choose to not have Steve there. So the main thing is that it is, you know, you're going to have to find that. And if you don't have that singular person that people are going to follow, you're going to have to find another, you know, solution.
And it seems to me that Apple is changing much quicker, more recently. So the two big things that Apple's done recently that I think are super uncharacteristic of the company, the first one, of course, is the acquisition of Beats Electronics, which I don't, you know, this is something would be unimaginable, I think, a couple of years ago, at least for me. And the second one was the Pride video that was released yesterday. Of course, Apple had a big presence at San Francisco's Gay Pride Parade. And yesterday, there was videos of heavily produced, very, you know, emotional kind of video of the kind you'd expect from Apple. But those people in the video are Apple employees. When have you seen Apple employees, like, being presented as, like, get to know us. We are these warm and fuzzy people. We are people. You know, this is a very un-Apple thing to do.
But the thing is, Apple has to. They have to show up for these kind of cultural things, because otherwise, you know, they're also competing not just for consumer electronics, but they're also competing for employees. You know, with Facebook, with Google, both who had large presences in many of the Pride parades. So, you know, and they don't want to be seen as non-progressive. Because that affects the people that they're looking for. It's going to affect that, and so I think that he did it from a genuine perspective, but those are the kind of things that Apple, that I think that Steve didn't think that was necessary,
right?
You know, for them to do, and that he understands now that they don't have, when you don't have someone that everyone just wants to go work for, you do have to think about all these other bits and pieces.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, there's the environmental aspect. I mean, Apple has been criticized heavily by environmental groups for many years for their environmental record. And again, the message seemed to be a few years ago from the Steve Jobs version of Apple. Look, you know, we're you know, okay on in the environment, but, you know, the important thing is we make these great products, and that's how we help everybody. We make fantastic devices. Nowadays, Apple seems to be really pushing to become much more environmentally friendly. This was addressed in the article that we're talking about. And in fact, yesterday, I think we learned that they are investing $55 million in a new 100-acre, 17.5-megawatt solar farm to have cleaner energy for one of their data centers.
I think both Apple and Google are competing to be the first company that is off the grid. Like, you know, to say, like, yeah, we're off the grid, we're a completely renewable resource.
Self-sufficient.
You know, I think that, because both of them are investing heavily in that. A lot of other companies are too, but I think that they're, because I think someone wants that notch.
Yeah.
Of saying that we're completely
growing long bushy beards, and now we're designing our own flags. We're stockpiling weapons.
Exactly.
That's right.
Don't try that. It's a master light.
It's not just that they're worried that the entire energy infrastructure in the United States is completely
broken.
Actually,
the spaceship campus would be a great place for the zombie apocalypse. There's a lot. There's underground bunkers. There's all kinds of things you can do. So that's where I'm going.
Well, I think the thing is, you could shut all the outside doors from World War Z, and you could just be inside.
Hopefully they'll use sapphires, the glass around the outside. That would be absolutely fantastic.
Like Wally, it can go into orbit.
Right, exactly. That's right. We're going to find out. So one other point in this article that I thought was kind of interesting is that he pointed out as one of the, you know, on his list of reasons why Tim Cook is a warm and fuzzy person is that he's more willing to share attention. So one example of that, of course, is that he hired, you know, he essentially is a kind of acqui-hire of Beats Electronics. And so now we've got these towering personalities from the music industry who are now executives at Apple, at least ostensibly, Jimmy Iovine and Dr. Dre. But the other one is that he pointed out that at the most recent developer conference, he allowed Craig Federighi to dominate the stage. And I wonder how much of that is Cook sharing the attention and how much of that is Federighi being groomed to be a successor. Is that a possibility there? What do you think about that?
I don't really think so. Tim Cook is a young person. He's got a lot of time in that seat if he wants to stay there. He certainly has the success that will means that he's not going to be leveraged out of that seat if he doesn't want to leave it. I think it's mostly because I think that he's smart enough to have learned the lesson of some of the bad things about having such an iconoclastic figure as the CEO. Anytime we talk about any of these articles that talk about, the post Steve Jobs era of Apple, which has been going on for at least 3 years now, maybe the mainstream press should not worry so much about this anymore. Maybe this is an old issue. As much as I like to talk about that sort of stuff, I also have to acknowledge that this is a problem of Apple's own making, because if the public and if the mainstream press have been taught that Apple was Steve Jobs, and Steve Jobs was the visionary that led to every single thing that happened correctly, and nothing good would have come out of Apple if not for Steve Jobs personally having hands-on, hip-deep, wading into every single project, that's the message that they were sending correctly or incorrectly by having him front and center with every single one of these presentations. Remember that during a later Apple Steve notes, we would actually sort of count the amount of stage time that Steve would get, and we'd be concerned when he started handing things off to other people, and we started, is his health taking another turn now? Why is he not talking about this wonderful feature about editing photos right now? So I think that I'm guessing that Tim, or at least the people who are in charge of Apple, are at least smart enough now to know that they should not let that happen again, because if they allow the public and investors and the other parts of the community to think that Apple Computer is all about Tim Cook and Tim Cook's vision, that makes it that much harder for the next CEO, whenever he or she comes, to fill those shoes again. They want to create the impression that Apple is a large, vibrant company full of lots and lots of people, most of whom you will never hear of or see on a stage. But it's part of the stew that makes Apple work is each one of these tens of thousands of people, or 10 or 15,000 people, that contribute to every single product that they make.
And my understanding is that it's actually quite simple. I don't know if this is 100% correct, but it's actually quite simple. They want the best person on the stage for every segment. And often that would have been Steve Jobs, because you have Steve Jobs at your disposal. You'd be crazy not to use him. He is the master presenter's master presenter. And now you have sort of roles. And Tim Cook has taken the role. He's not the It Just Works guy. He's not the One More Thing guy. He's the This Is What We Believe. He's Apple's core values. And he comes up at the beginning and the middle and the end, and he states why Apple is doing what he's doing. And then why it's doing what it's doing. And then he hands off to someone like Craig Federighi, who's going to talk about the technology, or even Chris Lattner is going to talk about Swift. And they really want to make it about the show and not, you know, and not one personality, because there is no longer that one personality.
Well, and I wouldn't be surprised if they're not constantly rotating these, like who the people are that lead one of these keynotes. I would be surprised if. I think that they're going to constantly rotate, because I think that this happens in every company. We do a lot of streams for a lot of big corporations, and you do end up with this thing where suddenly the CEO is not showing up as much, or the CMO, or someone else, and suddenly everything's wrong. You know, and sure. It's not this, and it also it's not just that everyone thinks there's something wrong, but it actually throws off the entire pace of the event by having somebody there for 3 or 4 years and then disappearing. And so I think that constantly churning this and building up lots of personalities to do that, I think makes a lot of sense.
And frankly, if you look at the Surface 3 event, or you look at some of the Samsung events, they do not have at least they're not presenting their best foot forward with the people presenting this stuff on stage. And Apple's lucky that if you have a Federighi or a Schiller, you want them up there, because they make a great showcase for your product.
Well, in just a sec, we're going to talk about the upcoming iWatch. I know you guys are sick to death of this topic, but there's a new wrinkle in the whole development and the whole chronology of the iWatch that I'd like to talk about very briefly. But first, we're going to take a break and talk about one of our sponsors, which, of course, is Audible.com. I've been an Audible user. I like to say that I think I've been an Audible user longer than Leo. I think I've been an Audible user since about 2000. Back in those days, it was a physical device that you bought where the service was actually incidental that came with the device. But in any event, I love Audible.com because it enables me to read books that I would never have the time to read otherwise. I do a lot of hiking and trail running and driving and just walking around. Housework, dishes, whatever, and it enables me, if I'm not listening to podcasts or netcasts, I'm listening to books, and I've read many, many books that are just so wonderful because the actors who read them really bring them to life. Audible has more than 150,000 downloadable books. These include all kinds of things like literature, fiction, nonfiction, periodicals, you name it. Audible.com is absolutely awesome. And I was reading about this book earlier today, I think in the Times. It's a book called I Said Yes to Everything. It's a brand new book by Lee Grant. Now, Lee Grant is an Academy Award winning actress who was on the blacklist, the Hollywood blacklist, for 12 years. She was in Valley of the Dolls and Shampoo. She had quite a kind of a crazy life during a crazy time. And she wrote this book that is all about it. And you can listen to this. And this can be one of your free books. So you get two free books when you sign up for Audible. I'm looking forward to this particular book. Of course, I've been a member for a long time. I don't get it free. It's, you know, part of my membership, but I'm looking forward to listening to this particular book. So if you want to download this audiobook or any other audiobook for free, if you're not a member and you want to sign up, go to audible.com/MacBreak. That's audible.com/MacBreak. And again, there's nothing else out there like Audible. This is a fantastic place for you to listen to some of the greatest books ever. I personally sometimes I'm a little ashamed, and then I think, you know what? I'm going to own it. I like to listen to classics that have been around for ages, and sometimes they have revised or unabridged editions that are just a joy to listen to, including books that I've already read in print long ago. It's just fantastic to do that, and I actually love to do that. And Audible has a huge number of classics and older books, not just brand new bestsellers. So you want to check out audible.com. And even if you're just on the fence or just thinking about it, just go to the site, browse through their collection, and listen to some of the samples. And I think you're going to be super impressed by what's possible with an audible.com subscription. So sign up for audible.com. That's audible.com/MacBreak.
I get along with people a lot better because of Audible.
Yeah, because you're not listening to them. You're listening to a book, right? And so, like, there's
I just
no
want
arguing.
To be patient with them. You know, because it's like I'll be at the airport, and it's like you're just sitting there, and normally you would just be like, cannot believe I'm waiting another hour for whatever. But instead, I'm listening to, you know, something.
Can I make another confession? I'm a writer, and whenever I hear we're all writers. Whenever I hear something that's badly spoken, I'm always afraid it's gonna screw up my writing somehow. Like, right. I have this almost superstition about it. And so that's one of the reasons I like Audible.com, because, you know, I think it's going to improve my writing if I listen to a Shakespeare-trained actor reading about, you know, reading some business book or something like that, which, you know. And so I want a really good voice in my head. Yes. I don't want some hack in there, exactly. Unless, of course, they're the author, in which case it's okay. Well, let's talk about the iWatch. So I've been wearing this bad boy since Google I.O. This is the LG G Watch, or the Gwatch, as Jason Howell calls it.
How do you like it?
I love it. I love it for two reasons. First of all, I love it because notifications on the wrist is a life-changing wonder. That simple fact is just, you really get it when you use it. Remember when the iPad came out and everybody's like, oh, I don't really get it. And then when they tried it, they're like, oh, I get it. I get it now. It's one of those things that you have to experience to really understand. And this, notifications on your wrist, of course, just talking about notifications, not all the other incredible things you can do when apps are brought into the picture. So that's one reason. Notifications should live on the wrist.
Which, of course, is kind of funny because it's the one thing I don't want. Like, I don't even like notifications on my computer. I don't like to be interrupted. So the number one thing I was worried about was, like, hope I can turn the notifications on. There's a lot of things I'm just two different views.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things I'm super excited about with a watch. But it's just funny that.
Well, I'm a Google fan, so I use Google Calendar. I use lots of Google stuff, and I miss things because with Google, you know, you don't.
I do have my calendars.
Yeah, if you okay,
I miss a lot of meetings.
Right. So if Google isn't actually open in a tab on your browser, you won't get a notification on your desktop if you're just doing the vanilla, like, sort of cloud version of Google Calendar, for example. So, you know, right off the bat, you miss nothing. Like, you get everything on your watch, and you can just glance and go, oh, I don't have to worry about that right now. And it's, you know, that you spent a third of a second. On a process that used to take a couple of seconds. Sounds like nothing, but it actually adds up to something that's really effective. But the other thing that's fantastic about this is having Google Now on the wrist. Now, Google Now is a great service. I know that we talk about it a lot in comparison with Siri, but of course what Google Now has that Siri does not is a lot more preemptive notifications that sort of, you know, it rummages through your Gmail and says, oh, you know, I see you have a flight coming up. And then it says, oh, you know, you better get to the airport because the traffic is bad, so you have to leave right now. Little weird little things like that. There's a new report coming out today out of Boy Genius Report talking, for example, about how you'll be able to control all of your media, no matter where it is, through Google Now. You just talk to it and say, you know, pause or whatever. And that kind of functionality, the wrist is the right place for something like Google Now. It's going to be an incredible place for Siri.
And long battery life. I mean, part of the reason that I can't have something that's constantly connected is that I'm constantly charging my phone.
Yeah.
You know, and so maybe I'm the only one that has this problem, but I feel like, you know, an iPhone lasts about half a day. And so I'm constantly trying to figure out where I'm going to plug it in. So I don't always have my phone, you know, with me.
Well, the bad news is that now you have to constantly charge your phone and your watch. So now,
well, just a question, but I think that a lot of people have been talking about 1 week, you know, or three or 4 days of usage between charges, and I think that that's part of the key. Yeah.
This thing is a day, but that's not the wrinkle that I referenced earlier. The wrinkle is that Apple has poached, as they say, an executive from a Swiss watch manufacturer, Tag Heuer. His name is Patrick Pruneau, I think I'm pronouncing that right. You're in Montreal, Rene Ritchie. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Pruneau, I think.
Okay, let's go with your pronunciation. That sounded a lot better. And what's interesting to me about this is they're not hiring a genius designer, engineer who knows how to design watches. They're hiring somebody whose specialty is selling watches in the luxury marketplace, not selling watches through Best Buy, not selling watches to gadget freaks.
I don't know if they make any watches that cost less than like $2,000.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think that watch company, I think everything is.
But what does this hire say about Apple's intentions, if anything?
Definitely really not looking at bargains.
Yeah, it really does change my thinking. I mean, we've talked about the prospective Apple wearable so long that just during the show, I've come up with the idea that I really want to write a column that's just simply the Andy Anatko talks about Apple wearables bingo card. All the squares that I will definitely hit, and if we have talk long enough about it. And one of the squares in the card is that I don't see them making. I would suspect they're making something closer to an affordable fitness band than an expensive premium watch. But this hire really kind of upsets that. that, because as you said, these are not they didn't hire some guy off a swatch. They didn't hire some guy whose job is to import millions and millions of cheap Chinese watches and put NFL logos on them. They did get someone who knows how to appeal to people who are willing to spend hundreds, if not thousands, of dollars on watches. The only thing that sort of tempers my confusion about this is that this is a recent hire, and maybe this is they're bringing him on board for phase two of watch production, as opposed to whatever they're planning to announce later this year, if anything. But yeah, it is a significant wrinkle, and that makes you sit back. If you don't smoke a pipe, go out and buy a pipe and some pipe tobacco so you can lean back. If you don't have a beard, grow a beard so you can puff on the pipe while you stroke the beard and think about what this means for Apple wearables in the future.
I'm going to do all that immediately after the show is over.
To Andy's point, I mean, when Apple doesn't release products, like the iPhone was not a product, it was a product line. The iPad was a product line. They released the first version, the original iPhone, the original iPad, but they were working towards the Air. They were working towards the iPhone 5. And I think a lot of what we'll see with the watch is similar, why there's all these different hires. Like the iPod was the original wearable. It just doesn't run iOS. It's not connected. It can't do anything in a modern Internet of Things environment, and whatever Apple's working on for wearables is going to exist in that environment. And if there is a range of products in a few years, I would not be at all surprised, nor would I be surprised if they run the gamut from a really high-end Mac Pro, you know, top-of-the-line iPhone 5S style device down to more reasonable things, maybe not an iPod Shuffle sort of a reasonable thing, but something absolutely more accessible.
And, of course, this hire comes as the latest in a series. They hired Burberry CEO Angela Arendt some time ago, the former head of French fashion brand Yves Saint Laurent. Am I saying that right? I don't know.
Yves Saint Laurent.
Yves Saint Laurent.
Thank you. I
watched Project Runway. That's the only reason why I know how to say that.
Okay, thank you. his name is Paul Deneuve. And so, you know, they're going high-end on all of these hires, and it all seems to be around the fact that, you know, Apple's approaching this like this is not a gadget. This is fashion.
And I think a larger question is it all, are they hiring all these people just for that, or are they hiring them because this is the direction Apple's going, is wearable, fashionable electronics, you know,
like Beats,
right?
Yeah, not really. I mean, that's
yeah. So I mean, so I think that entire process, maybe, you know, expanding the Apple universe into a lot of things. I think that Apple has a lot of people that would buy a lot of things from them, you know, whether we agree that they should or not, or whether that makes sense or not. But I mean, if Apple made appliances, I'd buy an Apple refrigerator and a microwave and so on and so on. I would, and I'd pay 50% more for it because, you know,
the fridge would be so thin you could not buy milk in gallons.
Impossibly
thin.
You'd have
to buy them in pints now.
Yes, exactly.
You'd finally go metric on the heels of Apple.
but I think that when you look at how do you take a one of the largest companies in the world and continue to grow, I do think Apple is going to have to move outside of iPhones and iPads and computers. They're going to have to start looking at all these, do the same thing that, you know, carefully, hopefully, but, you know, the same thing that Samsung does and Sony does and everything else, which is that there's a wide variety of things that you can buy from them. I think they'll do it slowly, but I think bringing all these people in, I think they're basically getting the mind share of some of the best marketers when it comes to upscale marketing. They're basically hiring everyone that knows how to do this well.
Yeah,
and that was the interesting thing about that article we talked about earlier, and Gruber pointed this out, is that for years we've been hearing that Tim Cook hasn't done anything. He's not moving fast enough. There's no new products. And then immediately now he's spreading the company too thin. He's putting Apple into too many businesses, which is something you don't hear about Google or, you know, who wants to get into everybody's business. But the minute there might be even one new product, suddenly, no, slow down, Tim Cook.
Yeah. There's also an element to the acquisition of Beats Electronics that I think has been radically underemphasized, which is the fact that Jimmy Iovine is really, really into, and of course Beats Music, the music service that company has been intending to bring about this world of what they call 360 deals, to implement 360 deals. 360 deals being, instead of trying to sell music and make money from music, which is, you'd have to be crazy to try to do that these days, you can't make money from music, is to take music and sell other things, like headphones, for example. And if you look at in detail at the marketing approach that Beats Electronics has taken, you know, there's the Lady Gaga earbuds and the, you know, and that's really how they're going at this whole thing. You're selling consumer electronics through content, through brand, through celebrity, through, you know, association with other things. And I just can't help but think that, you know, all of these hires, you know, isn't, you know, like you say, it's not necessarily about smartwatches. It could be about a new generation of marketing where you use sort of the branding attributes to sell consumer electronics in the same way that Beats has done with their headphones. Yeah. And to a certain extent, the way that Apple has sold, you know, iPhones. I mean, if you look at going to an Apple store, the whole experience, it's not just like, oh, here, we're just selling these goods because they're high quality merchandise. No, it's all about being part of this. It's
aspirational.
Yeah, exactly. And it's exactly what it is. And so they could be just intending to really turn up the.
And again, focusing on this, I think that Apple is, I think if we ever, when we look at these hires, I think if we ever thought that Apple was going to go for the low end of the market, I think that that is probably over. I think that Apple is definitely knows where they've succeeded and they're going to continue to move down that path and own that part of the market. I don't think that they're, but I think that, you know, I do think we're going to eventually see 24-bit, you know, mm-hmm. you know, because that sells stuff, you know, and you know, and especially if you move to a Lightning connector and you have, you know, a lot of other data that you can use your headphones with. I think that I think those are the kind of things that, and before we think that 24-bit isn't important, we just look at the Kickstarter that you know, for the, what is it, the Pone, is it the
Pono player.
Yeah, the there are a lot of, there's enough people interested in that, you know, that want the whatever that is, you know, the extra, you know, they want to, and some of it's completely ego-driven, and some of it is actually useful.
And I just, go ahead.
One of the enduring maxims about Apple is that their most important product has never been an iPad or an iPhone or a Mac. It's always been Apple itself. Yeah. And I think that it's interesting to think about what Apple thinks that they have to do in order to get to the next level of their existence, because there's so few tech companies that last 10 years, let alone 20. And now they really are, I think their eyes are on the prize of just being one of those brands that always exists. And I think part of that strategy has to be to not continue to attach their success or failure to specific products or specific product lines, but to make sure that that logo indicates a philosophy of design and construction that people are always going to get behind. I think that as much as we laugh about Sony's mistakes, they are a company that's been around since the mid-50s, and the reason why they're still a recognizable brand is because that, you know, they are now, they make cameras, they're into movie production, they're into music production, anything that is related to everything that has to do with entertainment or branding, they've got their logo on there somewhere. I would hate to think that Apple wants to become like an Omega watch brand or like one of these high premium brands that make really cool stuff that you don't know anybody who owns one, because who, for God's sakes, is going to spend $1,000 on a wristwatch? There are people that are out there who will do that. There's a lot of money to be made there. But I think that part of Apple's pride is in being on the subway, riding BART to and from work, and seeing so many people using iPhones and iPad minis.
Yeah. You also see the companies that Apple has been traditionally associated with them. Sony is one of them. The other is Nike. Nike being a company that thrives in an industry where, you know, they just keep churning out new designs, and it's, you know, you have to keep that BS, if you will, just the image of the company is what's driving up the margins, and you know that's the business they want to be in, the high margin business.
Nike is a great example, because think about, you, there are so many Nike actually often does ads that don't even promote any products. It's just, here's the logo, here's music, here's music behind the logo. Enjoy the swoosh, enjoy the logo. I'm not sure if Apple would ever become so empty that they would do, hey, look at our logo rotating in 4D space. Enjoy it with your new 3D perspective glasses. But I think that that's the sort of place where they would need to go if they want the ability to launch products based on their logo. Again, it's not just hype. This is the second time I wanted to bring that up. Interesting that a lot of us have been to China, have been to like the counterfeit market, and you see the Apple logo on so many things, even like flip phones that have nothing to do. You think that you're going to see nothing but iPhone clones, but no, you just see people just want to have a back illuminated Apple logo on whatever phone they're going to use. Yep. And that's the sort of strength that I think that Apple, I don't think Apple is proud of the fact that people might care about the logo and not care about the engineering and the design, but they definitely want people to associate that logo with whatever it is we're about to show you. Be prepared for it to be very new, very exciting, very well designed, very well made, and most, and as importantly as any of those other things, a product that we, Apple, absolutely stand behind and believe in.
It's not just China. I was at the farmer's market locally here over the weekend, and there was a guy making handmade cutting boards in the shape of the Apple logo. And by the way, the iPad makes a great cutting board as well. It doesn't scratch.
The Sapphire one's going to be great.
Oh, it's going to be fantastic. I can't wait.
Well, and I was like, as we look at the quote unquote Internet of Things, the opportunities for Apple to expand their current leadership into those markets is pretty endless. You know, and I think that at first they're of course empowering everybody else to do it, but I think that they're I expect to see them, you know, adding more and more and more things to what they're providing.
Yeah, and the Internet of Things and the whole wearables, mark my words, is going to be flooded with junk. The smartwatches this time next year or 2 years from now, there's going to be 1,000 different smartwatches you're going to buy. They'll average $50 each. And Apple has to rise above that. They can't just get in there and just be another device. They have to have
the high-end. Let's point out that Samsung... Go ahead. I'll speak after you.
No, I was just going to say that's the interesting thing about Android Wear is it seems that it's not like Android open source project that Google has taken much tighter control so that it'll be much harder to flood the market with cheap Android Wear devices. Maybe you'll get cheap Android devices, but the premium experience, I think they're trying to protect that more than they did with Android on the phone.
I think they could even be taking sort of the being influenced by Apple in that regard, because it's not just Android Wear, it's Android Auto. The Android TV product, those are all locked down. You can't put a custom interface on any of that stuff like you could on Android. And I have the feeling that, and also the Android One initiative for emerging markets, that's apparently also locked down. Yep. So I think that Google has learned that they know better than the Samsungs of the world and really want to push a uniform user interface.
So the cheap ones will be really terrible now.
Yeah, that's right. They'll be really terrible.
But let's remember everything that the Android market did to improve phones and to improve tablets. Apple said that, well, the reason why we made this 9.7 inches is because to make it smaller is stupid. And if people say that you want a smaller tablet, you're wrong. And then Samsung and all these other companies said, well, tell you what, we've got some extra cash. Why don't we just put some smaller tablets on the market? What do you know? People actually do like smaller tablets, so long as it's not running Android 2.3. Same thing with like larger phones and different experiments with different form factors and different displays. I'm actually looking forward to the legendary 50 smartwatches that might come out next year, because 47 of them will be utter crap and will be sold blister pack for $10 at CVS Pharmacy. But three of them will be, well, tell you what, instead of the $500 rose gold, $1,000 rose gold Apple smartwatch that does a million things, here is a $99 watch with a monochromatic LCD display that does nothing but receives notifications from your Android or iOS watch. It does that one thing extremely well, but it doesn't do much beyond that. But guess what? It's $99, and you don't have $1,000 to spend on a watch that you don't know if you're going to like. That might be the reason why iteration number 3 or 4 of the Apple smartwatch is, hey, guess what? We're making a $149 three-color smartwatch that doesn't do everything that the $1,000 one does, but you're welcome.
Well, hey, Pebble.
It's a really good point, and it's going to be a crazy market. And you know, remember when Steve Jobs said that nobody reads anymore, and that of course they started reading again when the iPad came out and had this great reading system and so on. So a lot of that is FUD. A lot of that is just Apple's attitude. So very interesting. Well, it looks like iPhones may soon be built primarily by robots. There's a chief executive of Foxconn's parent Hanhai, his name is Terry Gao, said at a shareholders meeting recently that the company is going to deploy 10,000 assembly line robots, mostly for iPhone. They're going to be used for other devices as well. And the machines cost $25,000 each, and each one of them can build 30,000 devices a year. I don't know how legit these numbers are or how real this information is, but clearly Foxconn said 3 years ago they wanted 1 million robots installed by 2014, which all raises the question, how does radical robot deployment in the manufacturing process for Apple devices and other consumer electronics affect the whole manufacturing system? That, you know, do you need to be in China, for example, if you're build, you're using robots? Do you need
can
all
they be
those
American
employees?
Robots?
Right, American robots. I mean, is it or do you, is Chinese? You know, are you going to need 100,000 robot engineers, which is something the United States probably couldn't produce very quickly? Well, how does this change manufacturing?
I don't know if we know exactly how many people Foxconn employs, but I doubt that, you know, if we look at typically with a lot of these robot systems, I doubt that they're replacing everybody. So it's not, you know, it's not like a clean system. So I still think that there's tens of thousands of people that will be working there and, you know, supporting these robots, doing all the things that they're doing. It definitely will decrease the overhead. I think that we may see the delta change between the cost of, the cost differentials mm-hmm. of what it would be in the U.S. and versus China. I think that there's a lot of reasons for Apple to move a robotic system back to the U.S. someday because I think they wouldn't have so many rumors. Right. So I think that there would be some advantages there. But I think that I do think this is a good wake up call for people who are constantly worried about the outsourcing of jobs that eventually, you know, if you're doing a low level job, eventually you're going to be replaced by a robot anyway. So, you know, from a larger job market thing, this is why we need to be looking at upscale job. You know, how do we train people for upscale jobs and not manufacturing jobs? Because eventually, and I used to work in a manufacturer, electronic manufacturing, and right. I watched robots slowly replace, you know, large chunks of our factory.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting. And, of course, the dynamics in China are changing anyway, even without radical robot deployment because, you know, the workforce is getting better paid. They're slowly cracking down on environmental things, which is raising costs. And they actually have something of a labor shortage in some areas.
When you look at the sheer number, they in that article they were talking about, they're still, after all these robots go in, they're still adding 100,000 new workers. You know, I mean, that's right. I don't know of any American. I can't think of the last time any American company said we're just going to add 100,000.
Right.
You know, workers. There isn't 100,000 people in the United States that could be trained to do this tomorrow.
That's right.
You know,
and I have the feeling that the alternative to manufacturing in China is not necessarily manufacturing and you know. In Silicon Valley or something like that. The alternative is often going to be Mexico or Brazil.
A lot of the why China does this is not specifically in that location with Foxconn is not just because of the cost. It's because of the scale. It's Foxconn's ability to add 100,000 people and have a system for that. Yeah. I don't think that's replaceable. You know, I don't think that that's going to be replaceable by many other countries or anytime soon. Mm-hmm. It's the fact that they can do that. It makes them irreplaceable in that sense. It's not just the wages.
Yeah. And do we think there's a trend toward trying to move manufacturing? I've heard people write this, and I've always been kind of like, I'm not sure that's a trend. But, you know, Mac Pros are being manufactured in the United States. The Sapphire plant is in the United States. Is Apple increasingly building things in the United States, or is that just, you know, a couple of
I think there's a lot of tax. Projects. The problem is that there's a lot of tax reasons not to build everything in the United States. And so I think from a purely corporate perspective, I mean, it makes sense to do certain things that you want to have a lot of control and quality and everything else. Mm-hmm. So that makes sense. These are small chunks of that. But I'm not clear that it makes sense for Apple to make assemble the final product in the United States for tax reasons.
Yeah. And
it's
of
also
course,
a lot of. Different. I mean, like, it depends on what component you're talking about, too. One of the advantages of Shenzhen in China is that everything is in very close proximity. So, famously, you have a problem with one component, you can walk next door, get it fixed, and everything gets fixed much faster. Apple can just send a few people to China. They can monitor that. But certain components, like the Gorilla Glass has been manufactured in the U.S. The Apple A-series processors have been manufactured in the U.S. because those made more sense there. And I think it's less about arbitrary geography decisions than how they can holistically make their product they need to make at the, you know, at the yield rate, which is as important as the cost in the right time for them to ship.
And of course, like Tesla, Apple is planning to fully automate and robotize their battery manufacturing for reasons I don't know. I don't know why batteries are something that lend themselves to robot manufacturing. But
there was a pushback on that article this morning, I think, from some of the Chinese media saying that they were talking about the robots in terms of the grossest tasks, like the fine detail tasks would still be done by human beings, but the things that could be batch processed and the things that didn't require as fine a touch would be moved over to the robots.
And there's some things that robots can do. You know, when you look at, like, for instance, surface mounting, a human can't do that. So when you get to certain miniaturization and so on and so forth, the robots allow you to do things that you just simply, you know, can't can't do with a, you know, with a person. And I think that there are some things, definitely the final fitting and the final things that will take way, there'll be another decade before robots do it. But definitely we're going to get to a point where you have a small number of people managing a large number of robots.
Yep.
Yeah. There's another line that comes to mind that, you know, you teach a worker to install a component in a phone and you employ them for the life cycle of that phone, teach the person to program the robot or maintain the robot that installs that component and you employ them for life.
That's the Shenzhen version of the teach a man to fish. So what are you going to do?
You don't want to tell a Foxconn worker that you mean that I could spend my day just fishing and eating the wow, what am I doing working here outside?
That's right.
Well, then you just tell them that, oh, well, realize that you will be fishing in China. The air is a lot cleaner inside this factory, believe me.
Even though it's toxic. Yeah, it's interesting world they're building there. And one final point is, what's a robot? I mean, modern factory equipment these days is robotized, it's automated, and a lot of this is Foxconn bragging about how high-tech they are. Well, in just a sec, we're going to get to our picks of the week. But first, I want to tell you about the greatest place in the world to build a website. I'm talking, of course, about one of our sponsors, which is Squarespace. I've been using Squarespace for many years. I built multiple websites on Squarespace. Excuse me. And this is a fantastic site because they really nail all the key points of building a great website. The first one, of course, is design. They have 25 beautiful templates for you to start with, and you can go in there and just use their easy-to-use tools to tweak and change your design. You can change the typography, you can add pages, you can add functionality, and one of the key things that you can add is e-commerce. If you need to raise money, if you need to sell things on your website, all subscription plan levels at Squarespace support e-commerce now. So you can, if you have a wedding registry or you want to raise money for your nonprofit or if you just like selling stuff, it's easy to use, easy to set up. And again, it's at all subscription plan levels. This all sounds very expensive, but it's $8 a month. It starts at $8 a month, and that includes a free domain name if you sign up for a year. And hosting is included, of course, and it's very difficult and maybe impossible to bring a Squarespace site down with any sort of attack. I know Leo's tried a gazillion times. He's thrown all the Twit traffic at it for the Sunday show Twit and has been unable to bring down these sites. Very importantly, Squarespace is mobile ready. They're mobile ready in two ways. The first is that as somebody who's managing your website, you can use their Squarespace Metric app for iPhone and iPad to check site stats like page views, unique visitors, social media followers, and that follows and that sort of thing. But it's also mobile ready from the end user's point of view. Squarespace will automatically sort of redesign your site on the fly if somebody's looking at it with an iPhone or any sort of phone or tablet or a laptop or whatever. It'll always look right for the device people are using to look at your site. So start a free two-week trial with no credit card required and start building your website. When you decide to sign up for Squarespace, make sure you use the offer code MACBREAK to get 10% off and to show your support for MacBreak Weekly. And we thank Squarespace for their support of this show. And remember that a better web awaits, and it starts with your new Squarespace website.
My number one proof of this?
Yes.
FamiliarLight.com.
Okay. Check it out.
This is my sister's site.
Okay.
My sister's a great photographer, but she's not super technical. Mm-hmm. You know, she knows what she needs to know about what she does, but she is the best photographer, actually, that I've ever met. And so she puts up this thing of her family talking about taking pictures of your family and friends and pennies for some reason. I don't know why the pennies are up there. But she put, you know, this all took, like, her putting this together, and it's not a very complicated site. I understand that, but it is something that someone with no technical web background just kind of threw together, and it totally works for her posting those things up without any really any technology. She did it all by herself, and she just told me when it was available, so she didn't even ask for any help. And
you say that's your sister?
That's my sister, yeah.
All right, well, I'll see your sister and raise you a niece.
Oh, there we
my
go.
Niece's website is joyarose.com. And that's joyarose.com. And she just put this site up, a Squarespace site, I think a couple of weeks ago or something like that. She's a designer. She's just starting a business for different types of design. And again, you know, very talented with physical media.
Right.
But not a geek, even though her father is actually a software developer. But she's, you know, she's not really that interested in messing around with a website and writing HTML code.
Yep.
And, you know, it's just, it ends up beautiful and she loves it. It's easy. And she has control of it. That's for creative people. That's very important to be able to have control without having to get, you know,
it's all WYSIWYG. You're figuring it out. You know, that's and you can add a lot to it. So both like the Pixelcore website is all Squarespace as well. But we've got lots. We injected custom code into it where we wanted to, where it didn't have everything that we wanted. But most of it is all WYSIWYG that we can change anytime we want. Not that we do very often. But yeah, it's a whole other story.
All right. So when we do the picks of the week on this show, who usually goes first?
Whoever you tell to go first.
Okay, would you like to go first?
Sure.
All right.
New version of, it's called Call Out, and this is made by, I can never remember the name of the company. Ripple Training is the people that make it. So the guys that do MacBreak Studio, so this is Mark and Steve, built this ingenious plugin called Call Out. Now, what Call Out does is for Final Cut Pro, and Noise Industries is the company that actually sells it for them. But what it does is it may sound simple, but if you're doing training or if you're doing promos for your product in video, one of the things that is a real like drives you crazy is making the little arrows and the little like this is how this works and little magnifying glasses that pop up. I cannot tell you how many times I've had to do a lot of work to make magnifying glasses work in a video. So instead of doing all of that, this does it automatically, you know, so this is a great little thing and you can very easily, you know, move little map things around. So when you're doing, whether it's for presentations, for training, for, you can see these little bits and pieces. Now this may seem like a simple thing, but it is a simple thing there's some of you out there that are watching this right now that just went, oh, I need that right now.
Yeah.
You know, because this is all stuff that it looks simple and you're constantly, it's a lot of work to do it well, especially if you're doing it like 5 minutes of it. Yeah. And so being able to just kind of throw this stuff out there and edit it very quickly and make it easy and have it animate is just a great value add. And so for those of you who do video, who do any kind of training or any of those other things, this is kind of, it's like $80 or something or $60. And it is, you know, worth every, you know, you'll get your return in like the first project. So anyway, but that's called Call Out 2.0 and the Noise Industry sells it.
Wow. That looks really great.
It's awesome.
Yeah. Andy and Notco, what do you got for us today?
Simple, damn simple thing. This is a phone/tablet stand called Stump Stand that, believe it or not, I was I was given as a goodie bag item a couple of years ago. But as things tend to do in my office, they tend to go into a box or a shelf until I'm poking around saying, I need something to do with this. And then belatedly last month, I realized that this is probably one of the nicest tablet stands you can get. It's about $25. But what it is it's perfectly designed. It's made out of heavy, heavy rubber. You can actually feel that it's got some weight to it. So not only the weight and the rubber means that it's just not going to slide around. The other great thing about it is that look at the profile where it's got this little notch cutout thing, sort of two-stage thing. Another thing I don't like about many of these stands is that they're good for this one thing that you have at the time that you bought it, but then a year passes and now you switch to a different phone or you put your phone in a case or you switch to a different tablet and now this thing is no good anymore. But this one, it's so flexible. Here it is on an iPhone 5 without a case. Here it is with a Nexus 5 with a very, very thick case put into it. Here it is supporting a nice thin tablet without a case. Here it is with the iPad Air inside its case, so you don't have to take it out of that case in order to stick it on your nightstand. And actually, you want to be really silly. Here it is on the Kindle Fire HDX inside its case, not even opened. And believe it or not, you can get it inside there, at least if you turn it around the right way. And you don't have to, the great thing is if you're using this as like a desktop thing or even as a nightstand alarm clock, you don't have to remove your phone or your tablet from your case in order to use this thing as a stand. It's not going to get knocked over. It's going to support the full weight of the thing. And if you switch to a different tablet or a different phone, or if you put something into a battery case later on, you're not going to have to take your phone out of your battery case maybe, in order to put it inside this. So nice and it's a very flexible solution. It's about $25. Which is not a whole lot of money, not cheap, but it's right in the middle of the bandwidth. But I like to think of it as the cost of the four $15 stands you will buy over two or three years because you don't have to keep replacing a stand every time you replace your hardware.
Fantastic. And how much was that again?
It's about $25. You can go to stumpstore.com. That's mm-hmm. where they've got like all the fashion colors, but you can get it at Amazon pretty much anywhere else. It's been around for a few years, but they've It is still an active product as I nervously checked this morning before choosing it as my pick of the week. They're doing the typical like Apple thing where, yes, it looks the same, but let me tell you about the differences we've made in the manufacturing.
That's fantastic. Very Apple-esque. And that is a huge problem. I have a little stand that I use for my iPad, and then I've got a new case, and then it doesn't fit anymore. And then it's like now you have this piece of junk paperweight that you can't use for a really bad reason. So that looks like a really super great product. Renee Ritchie, your pick of the week.
So I have a tip rather than a pick this week. And I was talking to a friend of mine, and he goes on hiking trips. And one of the things that he did is because he has an iPhone 5S with Touch ID is he registered one of the guide's fingerprints on Touch ID just because it was at a rather precarious, almost dangerous area. It was a highly advanced hike. And he was worried that if anything happened to him, there might be some trouble. So he wanted to make sure that whoever was there could get into his phone. You know, he could make emergency calls, but he wanted, the right context to be accessed, and he wanted to have a higher level. He trusted this person, so he wanted to have a higher level of access for them. And previous to this, you'd have to share your four-digit passcode or your alphanumeric password with them. They'd have to remember it. Maybe they have several to remember. And then when you want to take away their access, you'd have to change the passcode or password. Then you'd have to remember the new one. And now it's as simple as registering a fingerprint and then deleting it when you're done. So I started looking around for similar stories. And, there are some families who previously didn't protect their device at all because it was inconvenient in the household. And then if there was ever a burglary or something got lost, the device was just completely not protected. Anyone could get into it and do anything they wanted with it. And with Touch ID, they can register their fingerprints, their partner's fingerprints, kids' fingerprints. If they're worried about their kids buying stuff on the store, you can toggle that part of Touch ID off. But they could make something that their kids could get into if they needed to, again, to make an emergency, to get emergency contacts or just to watch a video or play a game if they're traveling. And I even heard from somebody who uses it in business because they have a small team and previously they'd have to change the password on the device that they were using for, I think it was order processing or order taking or something, anytime someone left or moved in the team. And now they just register and deregister fingerprints. So it's really become this, you have a lower level of security, but because of stuff like Touch ID, the convenience factor has greatly increased. And I think soon with iOS 8 and, Touch ID is going to move to other devices like iPads, I think it's going to be really beneficial because you'll have individual apps and also a wide range of devices that'll be just that easy to have security on, but grant or revoke access whenever you want.
Sounds awesome. Absolutely awesome. Well, my pick of the week this week is the Dodo case. Now, I know what you're thinking. You heard about this. This is an old product. And, of course, this is a high-quality case made with bamboo and canvas and stuff like that. I got this as actually a Father's Day gift from my son, Kevin. And I originally had a Dodo case for my first, I guess it was the iPad, when it was sort of like rumored and then you could pre-order it. And a year later, I got it and I finally got my hands on it. I was one of 10 people in the universe who had it. It was this big deal. And there was a lot of press around the Dodo case and the company back then. And, the hype kind of dies down. Lots of other cases get into the limelight. But this, having revisited this is for my iPad Air. This is a beautiful case. And I've also, in exploring this, learned a lot more about what the company has been doing in the last 4 years, I guess, since this thing has been around. So just to review what this case can actually do, I don't know if you can get the camera on the table here, but, of course, this is... Let's put that in there. You set it up and angle it up like that if you want it like that. You can also tilt it back using the using this thing. This little plastic bit right here, if you can see that, holds it up in a different, if you're going to do a presentation mode. I won't demo that. But this is a super high-quality case that will really protect it, and it looks really nice when you're carrying it around. Now, what I discovered about the company that they've been doing since, and I don't think it gets a whole lot of press, is they have custom cases that you can just go in there and pick all kinds of colors, and you can do sort of map inserts and book bound style and, all kinds of really great stuff. And this is made here in San Francisco in the Bay Area. It's a really high-quality company. And when you have a MacBook Air, I bought into the whole thing with Apple. When they came out with the MacBook Air, they said this is the thinnest tablet ever, and our little case, the little magnetic case, is the thinnest way to protect your iPad. I hate that cover. It's just horrible. One of the reasons is that I have a metal desk and it's magnetic. And when I try to pick up the iPad, that I get the iPad goes with me, and the case stays behind. But the other reason is if you don't get the if you want to put it up for you to use it for typing or whatever, if you don't get the magnet fully engaged, the thing just collapses.
Right.
And I've dropped my iPad.
I gave up on that case a long time ago.
It's terrible. This feels like what you want with an iPad Air because it's high quality. It's fully protected. You can carry it around. You know, like you, I travel a lot. Go to some places where, you know, you have an iPad. You're walking down the street with an iPad. It's a big deal. And you don't want it to be a big deal. You can walk down the street with this, and it looks like a boring ledger or something like that. So it has a concealing quality to it. These range in the mid-60s to the 70s, depending on whether you get the custom or the generic. They have, you know, again, lots of colors. They have metallic colors, even though they're not metal. They're, you know, copper and things like that. Beautiful cases, high quality, and they're exactly what you want when you have an iPad. Because you can take it anywhere. Don't tell my wife, but I think I'm going to get her that heart one because she's obsessed with hearts. If you look at that, it's a beautiful design right there. So,
I love the book plate. That is the candle on the top of the cake, the book plate.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, it's a signature feature, and it just really gives it a classic feel. I like it. So that's my pick of the week. Well,
and I have one tip that is timely.
Yeah.
So I just want to make sure I forgot to say it. As we all travel a lot, just a little note: if you're traveling now, make sure that you charge your iPhones and your Macs and everything else before you go to the airport. TSA is changing their rules, and they are now making you. And I've already seen it start to happen. On flights to the U.S. and I don't know about flights within the U.S., but I just saw it in Istanbul. They want you to turn your electronic devices on. They want to see them. They want to see them actually power up. There's evidently, you know, some chatter about using mobile phones and so on and so forth for bad things. So just don't show that they don't show up with a dead iPhone. You may lose it because you will.
They'll keep it.
They'll let you charge it once, but if you can't come up with it pretty quickly, they're going to take it from you.
Yeah.
So just definitely make sure that's just something that's happening this week. I've just seen it, and it was a little. I'm really glad that I charged everything, mostly because I had a long flight, and so I just wanted everything working. But anyway, something to keep in mind.
So Istanbul is one certain airport. Another one is the UK's airport. What is it? Heathrow. That one for sure. They're doing the same thing.
Yep.
So well, will they? Will they take it, or will they simply not let you pass with it?
No, they'll take it.
You have the chance.
No,
you don't have the choice of saying, okay, there's
they'll let you charge it.
My tablet. I will turn around. I will go back into find a power outlet. Give me 20 minutes. I'll come back and I'll show it working.
They'll let you charge it. Now I haven't seen anybody have it taken away from them, but the reports that I've seen are they will let you charge it. But if you come with something that isn't working, it has to work before you leave, or they're not going to let you wander off with it as well. They're going to want to see you charge it right there. And if it doesn't come up, that's the report that I've heard. I haven't seen any that actually happen, so I can't say one way or the other. But the report is you'll get a chance to charge it, but if you don't charge it and it doesn't react, you know, you're not going to get it back because they're going to take it apart. You know, that's the – and so
– So what if I buy – I'm sorry, this is a digression, but what if I buy a piece of electronics overseas and try to take it back with me as is my right? I'm giving it as a gift. I'll have to tear it apart. I'll have to charge it up. I can't take a sealed box, even if they're going to be screening it during through the X-ray?
I think that if you check it, you're okay, although then you're at the risk of checking. I think if you check it.
I've read about this, but it's the finer points that I'm still trying to get answers on.
And I'm not sure. I don't know the answer for that. I think that if you checked it, you probably, you know, the level of X-ray that their checked bags go through is much different than the one that you're, because it would kill you if you did that all the time. But I think that it's checked stuff, I think, is okay. It's carry-on that you're, because they don't want to have you have access to it, you know, in the, you know, there obviously we can think of many permutations that would get around that, but I think that currently is the issue, is that if you bought something like that and had it in a box, you would probably want to put it in a put it in your check baggage, which has its own risks if you're coming from the emerging world. It's just something mostly I don't – you should definitely research it. That's all I'm saying. I'm not going to say I agree with it, disagree with it, but I've already seen it happen. And so you definitely want to keep that in mind because –
That part's not new, because I know people who've gone through metal detectors and had the metal detector go off, and it was because of a non-visible piercing, and they had to actually show that it was that piercing and not something else that they were trying to smuggle through. Yeah, so well, I mean, like, they had to go take it out and then bring it back and show that there was an actual piercing involved and not something else.
Yeah.
Because they didn't want you to use that as an excuse to get something else through.
See, that's why those of you with unusual piercings, you're here to fight our battles for us. I want you to put in the full metal jacket and just really just set off the detector, force them to like to really gross them out with this thing that you've done to that thing of yours, because really you'll be flying the flag of retribution for all of us.
And while they're freaking out, we can tiptoe with
it. Put it back in. Go.
Well, yeah, it's one other point from this news, by the way, is that they're singling out iPhones and also Samsung phones. Mm-hmm. The chatter around this new type of bomb that can be placed into undetected into a phone is that it's probably they're doing it with iPhones and Samsung phones.
Right.
Specifically Galaxy line phones. So if you got an iPhone and you're traveling, make sure it's charged. That's the advice. It's dumb. And I'll tell you why it's dumb. If something the size of an iPhone can conceal a bomb, then you can just put that into a bootable laptop, walk right in, blow up the plane. And
now I have to charge my laptop too. Thanks, Mike.
Yeah.
Yeah, you ruined everything for everybody. I didn't want to mention that because now I'm going to know.
That's right. And on that bummer of a note, I would like to conclude this exciting episode of Mac Break Weekly. Andy Anatko, Chicago Sun-Times, thank you so much for joining us today and hosting. And it's been a pleasure as always. I listen to the show constantly, and so great to be able to talk back to you guys.
Nice to have you in Center Square.
Well, thank you so much. Appreciate it. And Renee Ritchie runs iMore and, again, a podcaster extraordinaire. Thank you so much for all of your contributions today. Great stuff, as always.
Always great talking to you, Mike.
All right. And Alex Lindsay, I'm sorry we didn't get to the question engine.
It's fine.
I just got so caught up in all the important questions about who Apple's hiring for their iWatch program that
it's all good.
Spaced out on it. But so when is your next trip?
Later today. No, tomorrow morning. Yeah. I'm going to Portland tomorrow and then into North Carolina. I theoretically will be on something that looks like a vacation next week. So, but I'm going to try to connect from Cape Hatteras, North Carolina for Mac Break. We'll see what kind of connection. I'm tempted to take our satellite just to see if it'll work.
You must have some serious miles on your card.
I'm stacking them up.
That's amazing. Well, I want to thank
all the miles.
Yeah. So I want to thank all of you, Andy Anatko, Renee Ritchie, Alex Lindsay. My name is Mike Elgin, and thank you, all of you out there, for tuning in to Mac Break Weekly. We do Mac Break Weekly 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern. That's 1800 UTC, I think, every Tuesday right here on the TWIT Network. Watch live at live.twit.tv if you can, or you can subscribe on iTunes, YouTube, Feedly, Yahoo, RSS, or whatever way you want to subscribe, or you can do both. You can watch live and you can get the download. Choose your favorite way to subscribe at twit.tv/TNT or wherever fine podcasts are posted. And now I get to say the signature line that I hear so much. Get back to work. Break time is over.